I'd like to call the meeting back to order on November 6th. It's 11:15 a.m. What we're going to do is continue a discussion, kind of an overview of the PPT structure on oil and gas. Earlier this morning, we kind of went through a flow diagram of the component parts, and we're going to now take a look at some of these individual tax areas, expenses, rates, progressivity, and credits as we work through our process. But what we're going to do now is talk about a little bit of the effect of the dollars coming into the state with these areas. And before we, I guess, jump right into that issue, we're going to have a discussion on lease expenditures and allowable deductions and how they affect the operating and capital expenditures, which are referenced in, you know, in your flow diagram today as upstream costs, which is the middle of the first page. With us today is John Iverson, Director of Tax Division, Department of Revenue. He's in person. Online, we should have Gary Rogers, Production Tax Manager from the Tax Division. He's on the phone, and Mr. Rob Mintz, who now is a contract attorney with the administration, who was involved in the original 2001 bill writing. He is online, correct? Okay. Questions? And with that, I'd like Mr. Iverson to come forward and start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, through the chair. A brief overview of status quo PPT and then sort of how that is being debated currently. As Mr. Chairman pointed out, the issue that I'll be discussing is going to be lease expenditures. That's in, of the tax code, it's in 4355-165. It is in the area of the flow chart under upstream costs. Under PPT, the upstream costs are known as lease expenditures. Those are items that are deductible in reaching the what's called the production tax value under PPT. Those are comprised of capital costs and operating costs. I would note that because capital costs are a subset of lease expenditures, then the qualified capital expenditures that are used for the purposes of qualified capital expenditure credits are also somewhat related to this. So if it's not allowed as a lease expenditure, it won't be allowed as a qualifying capital expenditure for the purposes of the PPT credits either. So under PPT section 165, the statute sets forth some general ways to determine what are allowable lease expenditures. And in general, these are the ordinary and necessary costs that are incurred upstream of the point of production. And the point of production generally is going to be the pump station number one. And those are the costs that are the direct costs, and that's going to be an important theme that we see, the direct costs of exploring, developing, or producing oil or gas. And in making this determination as to what's going to be an allowable lease expenditure, the Department of Revenue considers typical industry standards and practices in billing costs between one another, and then also costs. And that's under unit agreements, and then also the net profit share lease regulations. And those criteria are set forth under the statute expressly. Direct costs are deductible when incurred rather than depreciated under PPT. If costs that are known as capital costs under, for instance, federal regulations, are generally capitalized costs or an asset that lasts longer, that has a useful life of longer than a year. Under PPT, though, capital expenditures are allowed to be expensed when they're incurred, so they're not depreciated. There is also a reasonable, there's an allowance for overhead in set forth in the statute, and that is set as a percentage of direct costs of exploring, producing, and developing oil and gas.
Just maybe we could back up for a minute and touch on the difference between how capital costs are handled for tax reporting purposes with the federal government, because they're still tax deductible, still depreciated. And you can highlight that because there's two different methodologies of handling it that both coincide with this PPT.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. It depends somewhat on the asset for federal tax purposes, but it, as a general matter, items that are considered to be a capital expenditure are depreciated. So in other words, the value of that asset would be recovered in, as part of their tax calculation over time, over a number of years, number of tax periods. For PPT, that item is allowed as a deduction the year in which it is incurred. So it's definitely a compressed treatment, even for capitalized items. So there's no depreciation per se. Everything is essentially treated as if it's been expensed in that year and thus is eligible for the deduction that year, including capital items.
So a capital item will show up, if it's over a 10-year schedule, will show up 9 years after it disappears from PPT in their federal tax returns as deductions.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So we're not affecting that.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We're not affecting federal tax treatment. The overhead allowance, I would point out, there's been a bit of discussion throughout some of the committees in regards to the overhead. Overhead is set merely as an allowance of direct costs. So we audit direct costs. Overhead is set as a percentage of that. It follows that it doesn't matter what they actually spend on, for instance, lobbying or advertising or items of that sort in terms of how that affects their tax calculation, because it's still going to be a percentage of what they incur as their direct costs. And then we hone in on that prospect even farther in the regulations as to what those allowable percentages are. In PPT, there are two provisions. One is that it's in 165C and 165D. Those reference costs that are billable or billed under unit operating agreements, and I'll get into that a little bit further as I transition into SB 2001 and make this and have some discussion on that, on those particular issues. The statute, the PPT statute, sets up, once you get into the base level of what's excluded or included, pardon me, then it sets forth a number of exclusions from lease expenditures. So the structure here is a general fabric of what's allowable in a very, very general way, and then a list of specific exclusions. And there are a number of them in there. This is a 165E18. Some of them, it includes, for instance, net income taxes are excluded from the lease expenditures. Costs arising from fraud or gross negligence are excluded from lease expenditures. And then there are several others that the SB 2001 has added to that. But there are a number of exclusions in here. And when it is excluded from lease expenditures, that would mean that is then allowable as a it is disallowed as a deduction. So just to clarify the terminology there.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hear people referring not to Houston, Alaska, but Houston, Texas, about health clubs. Is there a provision that allows health clubs to be written off in any place in our tax laws, in PPT or any other provision?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the answer to that is no. And that has, I think, been part of the confusion that we've experienced with explaining how overhead works. Those sort of costs would be overhead. And overhead is set as a percentage of direct costs. So it doesn't. We only audit for the direct costs. It doesn't affect what they are allowed as a deduction, what they spend on items like health club memberships, in Houston, Texas. That has no bearing on their actual tax liability, because we don't even go into that. We set it at a certain percentage, and that's it. So they can spend much, much more than that percentage. It doesn't matter. That's all that we allow.
Senator Huggins?
What is that percentage?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that is set by regulation. That's 15 AAC 55270. That's 3% of non-overhead lease expenditures that are qualified capital expenditures, plus 9%, again, of direct lease expenditures that are operating expenditures. So it's still set as a percentage of direct costs attributable to exploring, developing, or producing hydrocarbons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
That sets forth sort of the general basis of lease expenditures. I would point out that there is also a provision, and this is in 55.170, that sets out a certain number of adjustments to lease expenditures. And generally those occur in instances where something has been claimed as a lease expenditure in a prior period, and then, or even in the same period, but it was incurred as a lease expenditure, and then there is some sort of recoupment of that cost. So, for instance, if you bought a drilling rig, then you get to claim that as a lease expenditure, and then if you sold the rig, then that would be an offset. So that's where that adjustments to lease expenditure section comes in. Moving on to where we go with SB 2001 then from here is the first provision there is we set forth an affirmative provision that would allow the department by regulation to set forth allowable lease expenditures. So this would take what currently is set in PPT as a very broad base of allowable costs with a number of exclusions to a narrower base of what's allowed in the first place, a much more clearly defined realm of allowable costs from which to start. The idea here, and arguably the department has this authority anyway under its regulatory authority, but the thought behind this is improving clarity and leading to less litigation in the future by setting forth and less confusion as we go forward by expressly delineating what expenditures would be allowable. Another point, and this gets back into the 165 C and D that I said I would come back to, these provisions are suggested under SB 2001 to be repealed, and those would allow the Department of Revenue to substitute cost billings under unit operating agreements in place of the general standard set forth in the statute or regulation. There are two primary drivers behind this. There's an administrative side, and then there's a policy side. But let me flesh out what these provisions would do. 165C it provides that if the Department of Revenue makes the finding that parts of a unit operating agreement are substantially consistent with general standards of allowable lease expenditures, then the department would authorize a producer to treat as its lease expenditures the cost that would be billable under that operating agreement. Under D, then, that takes that a step further and says if the department makes that finding of substantial consistency with the statute and its regulations, and in addition finds that at least one working interest owner in a unit has the substantial incentive and ability to audit and is in fact effectively auditing the billings, then costs that are actually billed under the agreement would be allowed as lease expenditures. This creates, I'll start with the administrative concern first. What this effectively means is that the Department of Revenue has to carefully track the unit operating agreements and the terms of those agreements. Those agreements are moving targets, and the accounting procedures in them are not set in stone, and in fact they are often in flux. This also sets forth a subjective finding where we're trying to make a determination of what's substantially consistent with the regs and also and the statutes, and also gets us into a gray area in regard to accepting joint audit findings based on this effectively auditing criteria. So we essentially end up doing a multi-track audit as opposed to just auditing what costs were billed. We would be auditing the audit that has been incurred by the joint interest owners, and we would also be having to look and effectively audit the operating agreement. So this sets up a multi-layered track of confusion. Several other concerns here is that substantial compliance with the standards set forth in the statutes and the regs isn't precise correspondence with the statutes and the regs. So this could effectively allow for some variance between what the taxpayer is claiming and what's actually allowed in the statute, and it could also allow for disparate treatment between taxpayers, potentially. Some producers could be treated somewhat differently as to what is actually deducted. There's imprecision regarding cost allowances under the agreements. I touched on that. There is also, as a policy matter, a concern with this sort of shifting of responsibility to the taxpayer to determine what costs are going to be allowed as lease expenditures, as opposed to the department. Although always maintaining that authority, the department's not comfortable with that shifting of authority. We don't find that that's appropriate. And these determinations put the department in a very difficult position in that we are using an agreement that has been formulated in the past to predict the future. In other words, we're looking at an operating agreement, and then we're trying to discern whether they are continuously staying substantially consistent with the standards set forth in the statute. So it creates an odd forward-looking perspective for the department. Other issues that in the ACES bill, so that anyway, that covers 165 C and D, and that's why we suggest that be repealed. We have also added a provision to address the concerns that were put forth in Senate Bill 80 last spring. The language that we have been contemplating for that is an exclusion that is based on, and I always like to dig into this language because it helps me to keep this clear, so we don't start getting any of the terminology off here. This would set forth an exclusion for costs incurred for repair, replacement, or deferred maintenance of a facility or a pipeline or other facility that is undertaken in response to a failure, an unscheduled disruption in production or reduction in production, or a sort of a spill or a release of a hazardous substance event. We believe that is a narrower in terms of actual administration. It's going to be a more usable, workable standard than the standard set forth in Senate Bill 80, which was an improper, which would have required the department to make determinations based on improper maintenance. And this gets us into looking at whether there was an unscheduled disruption in production. We can't, and it's a very difficult task, would be a difficult task under a bill like Senate Bill 80 for an auditor to make a determination of improper maintenance. And we think that this makes that determination a more objective finding, because now we're looking at disruptions in production. There is a provision in the lease, this particular exclusion, that would allow the cost to be deducted if it could not otherwise have been prevented. So in other words, you know, acts of war, acts of God, these sort of things that could not have been prevented by the taxpayer. There's also an exclusion for the costs incurred to construct, operate, or acquire a refinery or crude topping plant, crude oil topping plant. And those sorts of plants are used to produce diesel and other products for use on the actual lease itself. We would allow, as a caveat to that, if The crude oil topping plant being on or near the premises of the producer's lease or property, and that property is being, or the topping plant is being used to create a product that's used on the lease, then we would allow the difference, in other words, the value of the improvement to the product itself as a lease expenditure. So if it's a diesel, then we would allow the difference between the fair market value of the diesel and the prevailing value of the crude to have that as a lease expenditure. So.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a reminder to the committee and John that we have asked administration to continue to look at this issue because the business of manually hauling this diesel fuel up and down the Dalton Highway, potentially pipeline it from Kenai, then railroading it to Fairbanks, and then trucking it up in the turnarounds and road maintenance may in fact be the answer. But I certainly hope there's a smarter way to do it so that, you know, we don't have one head-on collision or two spills or whatever calamity might happen. And then we go back and say, why would we ever have done this or not facilitated the topping plant? So the due out is still, I'm looking for alternatives that are feasible for the state to be a partner in.
And Senator Huggins, through the chair, we have been continuing to study that. And I'm assuming results are forthcoming. I'm not sure exactly what the process is on that.
Right. But, well, and just as a reminder, this is the last committee of referral. So we need, I'm anticipating this answer on behalf of the committee.
And I would like to remind administration we have a clock running of 30 days. So sooner is better than later.
Understood, Mr. Chair.
Also, if the administration can bring forward any current cost estimates of due to the Treasury of the whole corrosion issue. Every time we've asked the question, we've been unable to get an answer on what the corrosion issue is actually costing the Treasury, although we all recognize there's been a $260 million number floated around by the industry as far as repairs. There's also a $550 million number that's in their 20F, BP's 20F, so we're going to want to delve into that a little bit as far as coming attractions, as far as integrity management in the next day or so also.
Mr. Chairman, one thing that I would mention on that is that to the extent that those costs have been disclosed by the industry, for instance, what you point out is the $260 million cost, we can certainly discuss those. We can't, however, discuss any information that hasn't been brought forward, because this is not only is it taxpayer confidential, but it's also a matter that, to my understanding, is under investigation by the Department of Law right now for, I'm assuming, you know, potential use in the future in terms of litigation or negotiation, or I'm not sure what they're going to be using it for, but it is under investigation, so we're not at liberty to dive into what costs have actually been claimed or anything like that.
Okay. Just one added little issue. I would assume there'll be the cost that is claimed by the industry, then there'll be costs that maybe may survive the audit process, which may be the same or substantially different, depending on if the verbiage within the current PPT structure is sufficiently written tight enough to disallow them.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. And if for instance, the amendment that the administration has proposed regarding excluding costs associated with unscheduled shutdowns or disruptions in production is accepted, that would certainly give us a lever to go there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that there are just a couple of items I'm not at liberty to go too far down this path, but I would note that there are a couple of items that turned up in the CS that I could just comment on briefly. The first is there is language inserted that mentions allowing only as lease expenditures those costs incurred in the state. I think we can safely say that that's problematic. And then in addition, there has been language that has been inserted into the exclusion from lease expenditures due to unscheduled disruptions in productions that gets us back into looking at improper maintenance, and from the department's perspective, that is also problematic. And that was, in terms of an overview, Mr. Chairman, that was what I had. If there's any questions, I can certainly answer them.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that last point, I think the problem with the language that was in the original ACES bill was that many felt that it wasn't clear enough or definitive enough, and I was wondering if the administration agreed with that, and if they did, how would we tighten up that language?
Through the chair, I would have to take that back and ask and question the administration on that, and talk, meet with our team on that in terms of making that tighter. At this point, what you know, I can say that what was proposed under the ACES bill was the product of a substantial amount of thought and consultative effort. So, you know, it's another tack to meet that same policy objective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Have any other questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of along the same line, it's I don't know if it's a question or more a statement. It would seem to me that the practice that is conducted on the Alyeska line of pigging pipe would be directly related to the transportation line, the 30-inch line that failed and a lot of material was removed from it. So I just thinking out loud almost, it just seems to me that that would be pretty easy to craft language that, and that's why actually the improper maintenance language seemed good to me as far as what was taking place and the standards that are already conducted in what they do on their own, not necessarily just national standards, but even area standards, because we do have a different type of materials that are contained in the oil when it comes out of the ground. So I guess it's more a statement than anything else, but that still bothers me too. Thank you.
Do you have any further questions? Mr. Rogers, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Thank you. Yes, I do. I would like to discuss briefly what Senator Huggins talked about and Director John Iverson talked about. Looking at the committee substitute bill, there's some language in there as one of the disallowed costs is overhead, office or administrative expenses, and all other indirect costs of oil and gas exploration, development, and production. Well, this is where the audit challenge really is what are indirect costs? And the unit operating agreements in Alaska typically allow more indirect costs to be charged as direct costs than, say, down in the oil patch in Texas and Louisiana. We have warehouses in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, possibly Soldotna. There's warehouses at Dead Horse that a number of different oil and gas explorers and producers use. In Texas, those would be considered indirect district expenses. And I guess my question would be, are these the type of things that this language is trying to exclude? When you have a development project, you're building a new field on the North Slope, you typically have a construction office. The unit operating agreements normally provide that is a direct cost. In other parts of the country, that might be an indirect cost. And I see without clarification, I don't know if the intent is to let the department write regulations to specify indirect costs, to use the indirect cost definitions in the unit operating agreements, or what the intent is here. But this creates audit challenge, that term, indirect cost. And so the extent anyone can provide guidance or direction, it's that's going to be the future audit disputes, is what are indirect costs. Thank you.
The issue of, for example, engineering, if you had a central engineering facility located out of state somewhere, how would that affect these multinational corporations that try to synergize their, as is in this example, engineering and administrative duties?
Mr. Chairman, right now I think the way you would see that charged is individual engineers would charge their time to a cost center for a specific project, be it in Alaska or all the projects they work on. They might work for 2 days on an Alaska project and 3 days on a North Sea project. That's, I think, normal practice, and that isn't that difficult to track. But what gets difficult is these things like warehouses, freight, shipping, some of the fringe benefits on labor. Senator Huggins earlier asked about health clubs. Well, what does the particular unit operating agreement consider normal fringe benefits for its employees? And under the terms of 165 C and D under current law, are we bound by that or not? So some things are fairly easy to identify and deal with because they have a certain logic. An engineer working on an Alaska project, wherever he is on the planet, you can probably figure out how much time and what's a reasonable cost to charge the Alaska project. It's when you get into the fringe benefits, the costs of facilities that are shared, like I keep using, coming back to warehouses, but it's a good example. A number of different units on the North Slope may share the warehouses there. Things like that. And so I was reading this language and given your examples, if there's an employee working directly on a project, you can allocate costs based on his time. It's more problematic with warehouses and fringe benefits. Thank you, sir.
If I recall correctly, under the discussion of gas lines and the lack of the labor force in the Pacific Northwest and in Canada, and even the Southern 48, we were told that it's highly likely that a lot of the engineering and drafting would be done in places like India. So it might assume then that this language would exclude major projects in this case, the gas line, but we could call it a other infrastructure going after oil on the North Slope. That would impact that directly, those costs?
Mr. Chairman, if we did not have regulation clearly specifying what indirect costs are, I can see a situation where different auditors and different lawyers could reach different conclusions as to what are indirect costs.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. And kind of on the same point, I guess I'm curious as to whether there is language in the governor's bill or in any of the committee substitutes that makes it more difficult or the flip side, more easy for the department to draft those regulations. I mean, I can't see us trying to craft a bill that addresses warehouses or engineers or anything else. So does one version of the bill make it more difficult for the department to craft regulations that clarify those issues?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I think the administration proposal that repeals 165 C and D, and that in amended language of 165 A and B, allowing the department to write regulations while considering unit operating agreements and considering the net profit share lease regulations, would work. far as addressing this issue.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the answer, but is there something in one of the committee substitutes that doesn't work?
Senator Elton, through the chair, the current language in 165E22, where it just says other indirect costs, is very worrisome for me as an auditor.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Excuse me. Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but continuing the line of questioning from Senator Elton, Mr. Iverson, you mentioned that you had some concerns about the language in a version of the CS, I think it was Judiciary CS. I don't want to put words in your mouth. Could you just elaborate on that for overhead? Which is what we're talking about.
Are you referring to the E22 section that Mr. Rogers?
But whatever, I'm referring to whatever you said was troublesome for the administration.
Senator Huggins, through the chair. And there are maybe some other issues as well. To my knowledge, those haven't been fully packaged in terms of what we do and have not decided, are things that we would be comfortable with. The items that I picked up on were first the delineation of allowable lease expenditures only being those costs that were under 165A were incurred in the state. That is, I think, problematic as an audit issue. And we've got a lot of situations where there aren't necessarily the resources available in the state to take care of everything that would normally be a regular cost of exploration, production, development. For instance, although a seismic shoot may be done in Alaska, that shoot may be essentially exported to Alberta for analysis. So to the extent that there may be some gray areas there, that would be a regulatory challenge for us to get into that. And then the other issue that I pointed out was the Senate Bill 80 improper maintenance determination. Although the administration supported that in the last legislative session with SB 80 as a tool to get at this, I think there is, and I think the position is that the draft in ACES is a much, it's a clearer line of how to reach that same policy objective.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, John, for your comments. I mean, I know we're under a time constraint, but when we're making dramatic changes, in this case, we're talking about credits and the different write-off provisions, we kind of got to get it right. This is not one of those 90% on time is better than 100% late sort of things, which I sort of live by axiom-wise in my life. This committee has an awesome responsibility with a few days left, but we got to look at that left and right so that we know what we're doing, because we heard, the concerns, and, I assume when we got it about right, you'll tell us that. If my assumption's wrong, please tell us that when we get it about right.
Mm-hmm. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. Your language regarding unscheduled reduction in production, when and if that happens, aren't you still going to have to determine the cause of that unscheduled reduction in production? So aren't you going to have to look at whether maintenance was proper in some respects or things not replaced, which would also be maintenance-related items? And I don't have the language here before me, but people continue to use the word unscheduled reduction in production. So when it happens, you're still going to have to look at why did it happen?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, actually, the way that this is framed is it's almost a strict liability type provision. We don't have to make a determination of negligence or of gross negligence or even of whether it was properly or improperly maintained. If the cost is incurred as either if the cost results in or is undertaken in response to an event that results in an unscheduled interruption of production or reduction in the rate, then that cost would be excluded. So we would look, the actual initial trigger point is actual whether there was that disruption in production or a spill. So this gets us into an area of, it's more familiar territory in that we do monitor production, and other agencies do as well. And one of the provisions in the ACES bill would actually require a report, it's in the monthly reporting provisions, of any unscheduled interruptions in production. There's an underlying theme here as well that is, it encourages maintenance too as a policy matter, scheduled and planned maintenance. Because if it's scheduled, if those disruptions are scheduled, then it's allowable. If it's not though, then that's our trigger point.
And just one other minor point. Whoever else was on the phone indicated that, I'm trying to make sure I understand this right, that maybe there's too much subjectivity as to where a warehouse may be attributed to as far as its use. Obviously, if it's BP's warehouse and it's their warehouse, but we're talking more finitely about where it is attributed to as far as its ability to be a deduction regarding a particular project. Is that kind of what we're getting at?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, and I'm sorry, are you referring to the improper or the...
No, this is just the overhead costs aspect of it.
I would refer that to Mr. Rogers because he'll be making more of those determinations really where the rubber hits the road. Gary, did you hear that question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, through the chair. Yes, that's the audit issue that we would face, is if there's a warehouse located in Anchorage that serves the North Slope, and it's not on the North Slope, it's not in the field or on the lease, but it saves the producer cost, perhaps, by consolidating freight shipments, and we tend to normally freight as a normal cost. But those things become issues as indirect costs or overhead because most of the industry standards that we look at in other oil and gas provinces in the United States, these types of things are indirect costs. And unit operating agreements in Alaska tend to include them as direct costs. And so at some point there will be a dispute between an auditor and a company over what's included and what isn't.
Thank you.
Yeah. Please continue. You have a question, Senator?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a follow-up question to the first question that Senator Thomas asked, and I'm struggling with this, and as I've watched TV and what's happened in other committees, I've struggled with it. And so I'm going to give a scenario. Let's assume that a pig was run through a line that detected corrosion problems before a spill occurred, but that those corrosion problems could be attributed to a lack of proper maintenance or because there was deferred maintenance. And at that point, somebody could schedule some maintenance on those pipelines. That maintenance may even occur before there was a spill or an event that would trigger unscheduled maintenance. It seems to me that the problem with the language in the governor's bill is that all of those decisions that had been made for a period of years that led to the discovery of the corrosion still cost to the state, but in this case, somebody was able to schedule maintenance before there was an event that revealed the extent of the problem, and that that seems to me to not be right, because in both cases, whether there was a spill event that triggers the maintenance or not, clearly decisions that had been made for a period of years before there was a discovery of a problem led to that cost. And in either event, I don't see why that cost should be credited against their taxes.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I think you know, it's a valid concern, and the issue to me that has arisen in thinking about this, and I think this is the same train of thought that you have right now, is scheduling. You know, if I schedule right now to drop my pen and I drop it, I had to schedule. That's an issue that we're going to need to hammer out in the regs when we get to that point on these. And there are going to be some other issues that we have with implementing these provisions. You know, this is, again, we think it's a tighter fit than the improper maintenance determination in terms of administration auditability. But there are concerns, too, with this.
Okay. We have any other questions? We also have Mr. Mintz online. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Mintz, who we're all familiar with? Okay, with that, we're going to have a little recess to the call of the chair at 1:30 for lunch. And we'll also take another recess at 2:30. With that, we'll see everybody back at 1:30. I'd like to come back on the record. It's 1:42, November 6th, 07. We have a full contingent at the table. Co-chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. And we are going to continue this afternoon with a discussion with the Commissioner of Revenue concerning lease expenditures, allowable deductions, and the impact of on the operating and capital expenditures. We are going to either be finished by 2:30 or we'll take a break and pick it up roughly about an hour later and continue on until the dialogue with the commissioner is done on these subjects. And then we'll continue in the morning. We do have with us Commissioner Galvin in person with his undivided attention, as the other body is unable to get a document on their table of their committee for a couple more hours. But before we get going, I would just like to remind everybody to please power off their BlackBerries. There's interference with the recording of the audio. So if we could all just do that, it would be appreciated. We'd have clean audio, because we don't want to miss one word of the Honorable Commissioner Patrick Galvin. Commissioner of Revenue, it's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. You've asked for the administration's current position on a number of the items related to lease expenditures, the definitions that are included in the original leases bill as they've been modified in subsequent committees, in just directing the members' attention. What we're focusing in on, if you look at the, depending on which version you got, with the original bill, it's sections 57 and 58, which deal with defining, actually, I'm sorry, it's 50, 58, and 59, which are the definitions of what lease expenditures are included and then what are specifically excluded from lease expenditures. And the judiciary CS that passed out of judiciary, these are contained in sections 59 and 60. With the changes that were made, there's a couple places you've asked me to focus on immediately. And the first one would be in what's generally referred to as the corrosion fix. This is a new subsection 19 in the original bill. It's on page 44, beginning on line 27. In the judiciary CS, it's page 44, line 22. The primary modification that was made in the Judiciary Committee was the inclusion of language that was found in SB 80 the bill that's currently pending on in the other body that was passed out of this body in the regular session. And what we recognized, the intent of SB 80 was to ensure that the cost associated with the replacement of improperly maintained equipment should not be deductible or given as a credit. And what we stated then was we recognized there were some issues associated with the ability to implement the language of SB 80 because it dealt with a standard that was improperly maintained according to industry practices and other principles. And there was going to be some issue associated with how to differentiate the cost that met that burden or did not. And so as we were proceeding to develop what ultimately became ACES, we worked more closely with some, not only our own auditors, but also consultants in the auditing field. And we developed a more bright line approach to dealing with that issue, in that we wanted to have some sort of an event that would trigger an auditor, an accountant, to look more closely at particular expenditures to determine whether or not they should be in or out. If it's merely a matter of whether the equipment was properly maintained, an auditor is not going to know which costs require additional evaluation or investigation. And so we brought it back to our primary area of interest, which is that if there's an interruption of flow that is caused by the improper maintenance, then that would be a triggering event that we would want to focus in on the costs associated with repairing that issue. And so the language that is in the original bill is intended to provide a much more bright line standard, more objective, something that the accountants can, or the auditors can easily identify as being something that needs a little bit more attention because of this additional standard. What the Senate Judiciary did was they kept that in place, but they added on top of it the much more subjective standard of improperly maintained equipment, and the replacement of improperly maintained equipment would not be deductible. For our purposes, that throws things into a more complicated, a more difficult administrative burden, and we would prefer to stick with our originally proposed language.
Okay. Senator Elton.
Thanks. And this is probably more a failure of mine than Director Iverson, who I asked a question of this morning. But it seems to me that, I mean, you describe that as a bright line kind of a definition. But there are so many events that could happen that would not then be covered with your language. And I use as an example improperly maintaining a turbine that provides power or a pump that pumps. Maybe it wasn't oiled and it should have been oiled. But the fact of the matter is there are spare pumps, there's excess power generation, there are other things that can immediately happen that would preclude any interruption of production. And yet, under your language, those costs would be deductible even if an oiler forgot to oil. And so I define that perhaps as a bright line, but maybe at a point at which we don't want to draw that line, because there, if the criteria is an interruption of production, there are so many other costs that can be created because of carelessness that would then be that they would then be able to take advantage of.
Senator Elton, through the chair, what we recognized was that it was a trade-off, and when you establish a standard that is going to be associated with an event such as an unplanned interruption, you're going to end up both perhaps missing some things, as you indicated, where an improperly maintained equipment was identified and then they schedule the maintenance and therefore fall within the definition. But on the other hand, we're also going to exclude costs that are the result of perfectly properly maintained equipment, but that end up breaking down unexpectedly. And the question isn't so much, can we articulate whether this is going to end up resulting in more costs being deductible or less, because frankly, I couldn't tell you at this particular point. But what I can tell you is that this is something that we can implement in a way that I can anticipate providing my auditors with some sense of, this is what I expect you to be keeping an eye on, this is what I expect you to find, and this is what I expect you to look more closely at, as opposed to the other standard, which is determining whether something was properly or improperly maintained. We're going to need to have some external information coming in that says, hey, look at this particular item, this particular cost, because I don't think that it met the standard. I think it was the result of improperly maintained equipment. My auditors are not going to be looking for the question of whether something was properly or improperly maintained on a day-to-day basis. They're not going to see a causal connection between those things. We need to have something that causes them to look at it, and it may include things that are properly maintained. It may allow things to come in that were improperly maintained, but it is a standard that is, we believe, the closest thing we can get to hitting the intent, which is to exclude equipment that is improperly maintained and results in an interruption of service, and also can be implemented in a way that can reasonably expect it to meet the intent of the language. And so it's a balance.
Well, yeah, please, and I don't mean to belabor this, and so a short answer I'll be satisfied with, Commissioner. Let me give you a scenario. Let's say a turbine blows up, a worker is injured, there is a finding by whatever regulatory agency that was negligent, that what led to the accident was negligent maintenance. Under your language, we still wouldn't be able to disallow that charge off unless there was a production interruption.
Unless there was a unscheduled interruption or reduction of the production. And if I'm not sure what kind of turbine you're referring to, but if it's a turbine that is associated with a multi-train
or power
system,
generation.
Well, if the power generation, if a turbine goes off and it shuts down the system or diminishes the capacity of the system for some period of time, then it would be picked up. It would just be if it was a turbine that was basically redundant and it goes down and everything continues to move without any interruption or any reduction, then it wouldn't be picked up in this instance. But I don't know how many situations like that are likely to occur.
My understanding is there is redundancy in power generating capacity on the slope. But
and similarly, we may have a situation where you have equipment that is maintained at every proper standard, but it goes down. And it goes down for reasons that are just, unexpected part of the use of the equipment. And under the improper maintained standard, it would be perfectly allowable. Under this standard, it would be not covered. And we recognize that we're throwing the net in a different, slightly different way. We're going to bring in some things that otherwise wouldn't be covered, and we're going to allow some other things to get through that wouldn't be. We believe on the balance, this is a better approach.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your forbearance and the Commissioner's. This is a troubling point for me, so thank you.
That's fine. Mr. Commissioner, can you maybe enlighten us a little bit on your communication with the industry and as we work through, we'll go back on the record here, it's 4 minutes after four. We're going to finish up, and it'll be pretty short and sweet here, but we have had Commissioner Galvin at the table talking about some differences in some of the different language she's running around in different legislation and trying to get feedback from the commissioner on what he would like to see in the bill.
And, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just in summary, what we're looking at least as it relates to the lease expenditure language, the corrosion issue, we think we can we can satisfy most of the needs by keeping our original language and also perhaps expanding the description of what costs are going to be excluded due to the criminal or failure to comply with a lease requirement, that making that a little bit broader in combination with our original language. We think that that is a good solution on the corrosion issue. As it relates to the definition of what lease expenditures are going to be excluded, we think that excluding everything that takes place out of the state is a little too broad. And we also think that some of the language with regard to what lease expenditures are provided can be tightened up from the judiciary version. And beyond that, the judiciary ones is a good mix of clarifications from what we had in our original bill.
Do we have other questions for the commissioner? Senator.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just assume by what you're saying that you'll have some proposed language on both those issues.
Yes, we could bring some.
I think that would be helpful so we've got something to react to instead of trying to craft something ourselves.
Right.
Okay, I could submit it to the chairman and I'm not sure how it would be incorporated at some point.
Yeah, we'll take suggested language and we can bring some of that stuff back, but we'll try to work with the administration so the language is smooth and acceptable to both parties. Any other questions? There's a follow-up from yesterday. There was just some clarity on the range of government take, and does the administration have a targeted ranges or other than what's in ACES or?
Well, I think the issue of government take, as we talked about yesterday, is for us one step removed from what we see as the primary balancing of ensuring that the investment opportunities in Alaska are protected. What we would see is you'd want to also segment out your different price areas. If we're in the range of what we would generally consider to be the normal or slightly above normal profit margins, for lack of a better term, for the fields in Alaska, we would want the government take, as it were, that or government share to be what we see as our peer range. UK, Norway, we've been in that between those two. We think those two provide a fairly good bracketing of where we should be. As we move further up, since we're in that middle, as we move further up this scale, and we're dealing with situations where that margin becomes exceedingly higher than anybody's expectation, then we could look at increasing that level above that. But it would have to be tempered with how does the whole system look? How are we dealing with that mid-range and up to the top? But we think within that mid-range, we need to keep that area focused on where we stand in relation to our peers.
Okay, I think maybe in the future we'll be able to have some presentations and try to put some numerics on it and try to get it pinned down a little bit more. Do we have any other questions or issues for the commissioner today? He'll be back here, I think, tomorrow between here and House Finance. Okay, let me give you guys a rundown on tomorrow.
I was handed these earlier, forgot to mention it. Yesterday there was a request that we redo the slides.
Right, we can get with you on that, and we'll get them passed out to the committee members, the presentation.
Yeah, and what we did was we reran it, I think, at Senator Hoffman's request, showing the original ACES metrics. So
yeah, just we'll get that taken care of for you. We'll get them passed out so everybody has them. I mean, that is, and I do appreciate you turning that around real fast, Commissioner. Econ 1 will be here tomorrow. Larry Pulliam will be presenting. We're going to go over the issue of the original PPT expectations, the fiscal note that was issued under the original PPT, the dynamic changes in OPEX and CAPEX that the state and around the world was subjected to, and then the variance between where we expected it to be and where it is, and try to drill down into where the soft spots were. And we're going to start at 9 a.m. tomorrow, again with Econ 1. After we're done with the old fiscal note under the original PPT, we're going to start looking at the PPT tax rate, the 22.5% tax rate, and we're going to have a discussion and review progressivity, how it works, what is its strengths and weaknesses, what's the difference between it being on the gross and on the net, and who does it advantage or disadvantage. Before we get down into discussions on policy, I want everybody to come up to speed and have a refresher on the mechanics of what we're working with. But at 1:30, we're going to break. We'll probably run for 9 o'clock tomorrow. We'll probably have another, probably run for an hour and a half, and then we'll have a short break, and then we'll go till noon. We'll pick it up at 1:30. At 1:30, Commissioner Galvin has informed me that they have some updated analysis done on their expectations of oil production for the coming year. So we're going to have the administration do a presentation on expectations of production, because we all know it's a production and price game, and price being more beneficial to the state and for every dollar change in production. But we'll touch on that issue also. And then when the that presentation is done on the production update, we'll come back to Econ 1 and continue on with the presentation from Econ 1. And just as a reminder, Econ 1 is the consultant that did most of the analytical graphing and charting of the original PPT bill. So we're trying to keep the formats very similar so it's easy to compare, so we can go back and forth if members want to go back and take a look at some of the previous work under PPT. So we're trying to keep things synchronized. Also, Econ 1 has been in contact with the Department of Revenue and DNR on their modeling, so we're all working off of the same assumptions, so similar, it's not of any magnitude as far as the variance of the modeling. So we can discuss policy and not modeling variations. And I think that'll speed things along. So that's tomorrow's agenda, and we will adjourn till tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.